Accession number 27060, reel 5.
Reel of a taped interview with Bill Stacey in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 18th of the 5th, 2004, at the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Bill, can we talk about, I mean, you mentioned some of the experiences you were having in Greece.
Yeah.
Can we talk about what you mentioned as going up to VV Pass? You couldn't get there quick enough. When you were told, why was there an urgency, as you understood?
Well, the Germans had arrived at the proximity of Vivi, and actually it was when that was the time that the Germans entered the war, and they had to try and establish a front that they could hold until they could get things moving a bit. But as it turned out, we rushed up there as quickly as we possibly could, and from after the first 2 days, it was more or less a continuous falling back or retreat.
Well, let's talk about the trip up first of all, and what that involved.
Well, actually, we had a camp just outside Greece, just outside Port Pirius, where we assembled all our vehicles and guns, and checked everything out, and we spent about 4 days, I think, in preparation, and we just took off, and we drove through towns. At one particular instance, I remember we pulled up on the shores of the Aegean Sea, and I went down to the water's edge, and there was a boy there, and he had quite a big box full of crayfish or yabbies or whatever you call it, and I said to him, "How much?" And I held a 10-drachma note up, and he grabbed the 10-drachma note and ran away with it and left me with a box full of lobsters for 10 drachma. And at that time, the drachma was 850 units the Australian pound, so it was quite a good bargain, you know. And the people were very friendly on the way up, even in some of the larger towns. We had a good reception all the way, but as I said before, that there was... We drove almost day and night, you know. We didn't get much sleep, or since it was daybreak, we were up and away again, and sometimes we drove into the early hours of the morning. But when we finally got to Vivi, I can always remember the first position, the headquarters was, there was a tunnel come through the hills, and it came out just below Vivi, and our headquarters were just on the side of it, and our CO was very, very careful not to make any vehicle tracks or anything towards the where the headquarters were, because this is what this German aircraft were looking for. And of course, at that time, they had complete domination of the skies, and they used to fly around. I could always imagine an observation officer with his leg hanging out the side of the cockpit, you know, having a good screw with a pair of field glasses, because we had nothing other than firing a few rifles. And then after a while they barred that too, because it only gave your position away, you know. So, but we weren't very long there, maybe a day or two, and we started the withdrawal.
Well, it's before that, I'm interested, on the way up, I understand from Bill and Rex that often people coming back were pushed off the road.
Yeah, well, it was a very difficult situation, especially at night time, because naturally you're driving with no lights or anything, and all of a sudden a group of people would loom up in front of you, and of course you were moving as fast as you could, and I personally didn't see anybody injured by the trucks, but it was a hazardous situation. It really slowed you down, because they did come in groups. You know, you might get two or three stragglers, and all of a sudden there'd be a big group of people coming out of a village or something like that. And it made it very hazardous on the way up, to make sure you didn't hurt these people. But, and then, of course, later on...
You got the other Sorry, continue.
Yeah, just drop
trying me. To watch out for people that were coming out of the villages and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and like to see these people that had really, the war wasn't part of their life, and yet they were the ones that were being kicked out of their homes and didn't know where to go, just wandering along and living on the side of the road. And eventually the people were, there wasn't any food or supplies or anything, but we were very well provided for as far as the Australian service people were, because we always seemed to be able to get food, you know. But one of the things we used to do was to buy a sheep off a farmer, and he'd dress the sheep for us, and he'd keep the skin and the entrails, and we'd eat the meat.
You mentioned this chap doing that for you.
Yeah.
To what degree were you, was it a difficult scenario for you to be going up somewhere, not really knowing the full facts of what was going on or what you'd be faced with at the end?
Yeah, well, we all sort of discussed between one another what's it going to be, or, you know, what sort of action is it going to be, because we had no... And I don't think even the people in the top echelon really knew what was going to happen. They didn't know whether the Germans were just going to sort of block that or attack, you know, and as it turned out, they did. But in the bigger towns, there was evidence of that the Germans had already done damage, you know, to the villages, and especially the bigger towns. But I always felt very sorry for the people, because we were actually the cause of their troubles, you know. And as it turned out later on, they were in trouble, because the whole nation was just subjugated by the Germans, and there's not much else you can say.
Mm. So what was the feeling like on reaching Vivi?
Well, it's sort of, now this is it, you know, what's going to happen now? All the preparations have been done, and when's the battle going to start? That's what we were all concerned about, you know.
So then what was your initial experience of conflict, of real battle?
The first thing we found was aircraft, you know.
Tell us about that.
Well, the Stukas were the worst out of the lot, I always thought. At least with the Stukas you could...
That's right.
At least with the Stukas, you knew that they were on a Pacific target. But when the Messerschmitts started to come around and Straff...
Sorry, you were talking about Stukas.
Yeah, well, the Stukas were very bad, but the point is that you knew that they had a definite target. You know, you could see what they were attacking, but when the... Messerschmitt started to arrive and with their strafing, they'd come out of the blue. I mean, everything would be as clear as crystal, and all of a sudden away they'd go. And of course they got very smart too. They started machine gunning down the sides of the road rather than at the vehicles, because they knew that where the spread from the vehicles would be on the sides of the road, you know. I was amazed that there wasn't more casualties because of these things, because and it's a terrifying experience when it first happens. The noise alone is fantastic, you know, really six machine guns going and everything seems to hit you in the back of the head, you know? And you, when they're gone, you get nothing wrong with you. It was a terrifying experience. But once, it's like everything else, once you got used to the thing and you could look and see, you knew what to do, where to go, and sometimes it was better to stay exactly where you were, because Once the Messerschmitts got on the line they were flying on, that was the line they come down. They can't just shift anywhere they like, you know. Their angle, and once you saw the bullets hit the ground, you knew where they were going to go. So you either stayed where you were, or shot through wherever that you thought the bullets were going to come.
Yeah. So and your then first experience of a Stuka, give us an idea of what that was like.
Well, my first experience was that there was a pair of English eye tanks out on the right of the command post at Vivi, and the Stukas come over and and must have saw them. And they used to fly along in formation, and then they'd sit, you'd wake up after a while, they'd fly in formation, and then they'd get in line ahead. They'd move in to line ahead. Then the first one would come over, do a vertical and just go straight down onto the target and drop the bombs. The next one had come to the same spot and do the same thing. And the noise, of course, we found out later that they had tubes on the side of the fuselage with wires in them, so that when they opened these wires, the scream was absolutely like the air rushing through these cross wires in these tubes. The noise was fantastic, you know. But once you woke up, that made you feel as if every bomb was going to hit you in the back of the neck. You know? But anyway, I still think that the worst initial part of it was the machine gunning from the aircraft, and especially that what we used to get disappointed with, and I suppose we shouldn't have, because there were quite a few aircraft lost in the campaign. But to see these fellas just flying anywhere they like with no opposition whatsoever, it really got under your neck. I've seen a fella pick a rock up and throw it at the plane, you know, but just out of pure frustration. But I'm not saying that you ever get used to it, but at least you learn how to manage it, you know.
And here, up until this point, you had success after success.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty well. What was it like then to know that there was going to be this turnaround, that suddenly things had changed against you?
Yeah, we didn't realise that what was going to happen, I can tell you, because we were riding a wave and we thought that, you know. But what we couldn't understand is why we didn't stop and form a front and fight, you know. Everybody used to say that. No, why aren't we? What are we retreating again for? But we come to realise afterwards that the whole campaign was just a stupid thing anyway, you know, and we were lucky that we got out with what we got out with, really. It's
the feeling of being in Vivi, and then you mentioned you're only there for 2 days.
Yeah.
What action did you undertake during that time, during those 2 days?
We had a couple of machine gun posts, and the Germans started to come through the tunnel in this tunnel, and of course they didn't know that we were there. And after we opened fire, we didn't have any further trouble from the tunnel. But it was always the fact that you settle in and get ready for something to go, and then it'd be time the infantry would start coming through your lines, and you'd stay there and fire some covering fire, and then pull back again to the next position, and so it hedgehog all the time, you know. And then the Germans start to get some artillery working and do a bit of counter battery work, and that wasn't too good, but we didn't suffer very much from it. But of course the engineers were busy blowing bridges up, and when we were coming on our way back, we come to Vivi, and we were about 3 miles north of Vivi. We went into an encampment there, and we just pulled up for the night, actually, and we had an earthquake. And the Germans had been bombing Vivi quite consistently, not doing a great deal of damage, but I tell you what, in 10 minutes this bloody earthquake practically flattened it, you know, flattened the whole town. There's an earthquake done more damage in 10 or 15 seconds than the Germans done in about 2 days bombing. It's absolutely amazing. I've never experienced anything like it. The ground looked like, if you were on the ocean, it was just a big swell. The ground just looked like if it was a swell on it, you know, and just run along like that and disappeared, and it was all quiet again then. It was an amazing experience. I suppose people in Europe and those places, Turkey and those places, are quite used to it. We weren't. Yeah.
So your initial experience of the Germans, when you realised that they were slightly better than the, the Italians. When was that?
Almost immediately. Well, I don't think we ever thought that they weren't better than the Italians. I think we always had a more respect for German troops than we did Italian troops. And
but you were actually on the receiving end.
We thought we were. There was nothing that could touch us. Well, I think we still thought that after we came out, but the point is we always say that if we had the gear and the aircraft to back us up, we'd have put on, they wouldn't have got away with us as easy as what they did, you know. But, and the stupidity of it was that all these brand new 25-pounder guns and everything were, although we blew all ours up, we wrecked them and took the breech blocks off them and threw the breech blocks away, and there was still a dead loss as far as the beautiful guns, you know. But he could never understand why we were there in the first place.
Mm. And you mentioned some of the attitudes towards the whole experience too, particularly after one.
Yeah.
Can you describe to us the turnaround? Okay, who was it that told you you were going back, and what did they say?
Well, the CO, I think he's a great communicator, Colonel Strutt, and he said to us, well, you know, the situation here is untenable. We're going to try and get back to and form a better situation, which we did, you know, and we were well prepared and everything, but that there were too many. There's too many troops on the other side, and no air protection. That's the biggest thing out of the lot, that air protection. I mean, the other side can do what they like, and it doesn't matter how good you are or how determined you are, they've got the wood on you all the time. Yeah. Our gunners, even the Germans said in their reports and everything, the comments on our guns and gunnery were fantastic, you know. That didn't make up for the fact that we had no support, and there was nothing else coming either. And as soon as ever they put us in there, we were in there, and that was it. There was nothing else backing us up. Like it wasn't if we were falling back onto a bigger and better army. We were falling back to nothing. And of course, the Germans start to give Greeks. Saw what the situation was and decided to go home, you know.
Well, you mentioned that you'd been getting all this support up until that time, but on your retreat, how did the locals react?
Very good, very sorry. I saw a bloody bomber come over, and one of our vehicles was in the, as a matter of fact, it was a water truck. It was on the crossroads in the village, and this aircraft attacked it and hit it. That destroyed the village at the same time, and yet when we come through, there was no animosity with the people. They were fantastic, really. You know, their homes had just been blown up for no reason of theirs, and yet they didn't. You know, they were sorry for us, which made things worse.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you were falling back to nothing.
Yeah, we've fallen back to just what we had, you know. All that we had was up there, and with no support in the background, you know. Well, no, there were supply companies and all that sort of thing were there, you know. They were bringing that sort of gear up, with ammunition and that sort of thing, but we weren't falling back into battalions or regiments that were in reserve or anything. We were just sort of on the run, and that's why they reckon that the Greek campaign was an artilleryman's campaign, for the simple reason that the infantry was coming back through our lines, and we were sort of holding the Germans up until they got a chance to reform some distance back towards Athens. Then we'd do exactly the same thing again. You know, we'd go back and set our gun positions up, and the infantry would come back through it, and away we'd go again. So, aren't we cool? I always felt very sorry for the policemen in Athens, because when we were going through, they'd be calling out, Germany, English, Australian. They didn't know, the policemen, naturally, and they didn't know what side was coming through. I felt very sorry for them, you know, because they're, irrespective of war or anything else, there's still got to be law and order in big cities and towns and that sort of thing, you know. Otherwise, in spite of everything, the bad part of the population will tear the place to pieces. So they're vital people, the police in a... and you think about that afterwards, it's something that wouldn't have even occurred to me, what happens when a country's overrun, you know. But you've still got to have that structure there to take control, you know. And most armies make sure that the civil police are well looked after and cooperative, you know. And even when we got down to our evacuation point, I think it was the name of the place, Porto Rafti or something like that.
How long had it taken you to get there?
In days.
Roughly.
Oh, geez, I think it was a week or something. That's one of the things with me. I can't put times and distances together.
That's all right. Yeah. Not a problem.
But,
it's quite a long time ago. You're allowed.
Yeah, but even afterwards,
But in relation to the process of retreat, can you describe that to us? Was there any sense? To what degree was there a sense of panic?
Well, I don't think there was any panic. I really don't, because it was all extremely well organised. You know, when we retreated to a set plan. And we followed it right to the last point where we were blowing guns, and any gun that went over on its side or anything, well, that was destroyed where it was. One few guns went over the side of culverts and that sort of thing. And I think the 2nd Field Regiment, they went around the mountains on the wrong road. They weren't supposed to go, and they lost quite a bit of stuff there.
Well, okay, there may not have been panic, but there certainly sounds like there was a degree of urgency.
Oh, yes, and when we got into the mountains, you know, the cold, and we weren't set up for... we were up the desert, you know, and we weren't set up, and the snow and the sleet and the roads that we were coming down on, you know, the dirt roads with about a 10 degree angle from the top to the up against the, you drive along and get up as close to the bank as you could, and then drive slowly, and the vehicle would just gradually slide down. A mate of mine, Maxie Wilson, he opened his truck door to get out and have a wee. And if he hadn't have had hold of the handle of the car door, he'd have dropped about 3,000 feet. He'd slid right down onto this shelf of rock, and the next bit was straight down, you know. Oh, of course, they're high, those mountains, in like permanent snow caps on those things in Greece. And the LCO, a lot of the people were starting to go to sleep, and so he knocked the windscreens out with the butt of a rifle, and that kept you awake, I can tell you, you know. Stuff blowing in on you, it was necessary, because people just in the warmth of the vehicle, you know, and the gun crews are all in Morris quads, and they're all enclosed, you know, so their body heat used to, the CA didn't like that. He liked people to be up and alert. Yeah.
What of the situation where you were being harassed? You mentioned Stuka and Messerschmitt. How long did that period last for?
Oh, that was all the way back, you know, every inch of the bloody way. When they could see, we used to pray for rain, you know, to keep them away. Every minute that of daylight, from early morning till night, they were in relays, you know. It wasn't a continuous thing, like a group would come and do their job, and then they'd probably go back and refuel or wherever they wanted to go to, had to go to, and they'd come back again and give you buggery again. And of course...
The sense of helplessness, how are you coping with that? The fact that you couldn't do anything about these planes.
Yeah, well, you know, I suppose it's part of war, and that's your job, and that's what you've got to cope with, and that's what you do, you know. All you're hoping for under those circumstances, you don't collect one. You know, I felt very sorry for the people. You know, lots of Greek civilians killed with the strapping. You know, but I couldn't understand, and they wouldn't get off the bloody road. You know, they'd see the vehicles coming down, and yet more or less at the elbow your way through the people. You know, I think sometimes the Germans realised that too, and that they eased up a bit. I remember one day there, there was hundreds of people along the side of the road, and this group of three Messerschmitts came over, and they strafed down one side of the road, and then they turned around, formed up again, and flew away somewhere. But I think they realised that there was a big civilian content there. Might have been some more humane German, I don't know. But very, very discouraging when you come to realise that there's never ever going to be a point where you stop them and a battle goes on, you know. It's just hit and move and hit and move and hit. And I think in that sense we done better than what the Germans done. I think the Germans lost more casualties because they were the ones that were doing the pressing, you know. Although they woke up after a while and they'd only come so far and then back off, you know, or not back off, but wait until our movement happened and then they'd move on, you know. You wouldn't have to be a genius to work out that what was going on, you know. But we were extremely lucky that we did get out of there, that we weren't all POWs, you know. We were, you know, because completely surrounded. There was only one way out, and that was by the sea, which...
Rex and Bill Osborne talk of being shelled.
Yeah.
What was it like being shelled for the first time?
Well, shell fire's a different thing altogether, in my opinion. It's the worst way to destroy things that I've ever seen, anyway. It's something entirely different. I mean, the carnage it causes if it gets anywhere near, you know, strafing's all right, that's bullets and that sort of thing.
Pretty big bullets, though.
Yeah. but shell fire, bloody... I remember me and two other fellows, we got underneath this... olive tree, and somebody had made a sanger of stones around the base of it, and we were down, and this aircraft come along, and it was on the sunken road on two sides. It was a junction of two roads, one road coming into two, and the bomb hit right on the bank, top of the bank on the junction of the two roads, and we were in this sanger on the same level as the top of the bank, and it cut the olive tree completely off, just 6 inches above where we were crouched down in this thing. Must have been a decent sort of fragment of the bomb. It just cut it off and blew it away. One minute we were under the tree and the next minute there was no tree, you know. But if it had, you know, we could have been 6 inches higher or 6 inches lower, and, you know, that's the luck of the game, I suppose. I don't know. I don't think bombing is like being under shell fire, because... it's so... the noise and the... you don't know where everything... in the other ones, the bombs and the machine guns, you know where it's... and you can see where the action's coming from. But with shell fire, I mean, it happens 5 or 6 miles away and all of a sudden something lobs in the middle of everything, and it's...
What sort of warning are you given?
You know, it's fucking none.
Can you hear
the
it?
You don't hear the first one. That's the warning. And from then on, you're busy looking for somewhere to get below ground, you know. But it's the, you know, you, if you haven't got slit trenches, you, that's the first thing they learn to dig slit trenches when they come under shell fire. Yeah.
Well, you see in movies, you know, people walking around.
Oh yeah.
all that stuff.
I don't never experienced that. Yeah. I don't suppose I ever listened for it either. Yeah, if it get your head down and stay down. Yeah. It's so deadly, those, like the fragmentation in those shells is entirely different to bombs. It's, you know, bombs make a big hole and that sort of thing. Some of these shells, you know, they hardly make a dent in the ground. It's all above the ground where it comes. Mm. Not that we got too much, a great deal of it, but it's two spots. We come under shell fire in Greece and one in Crete, and it's not real good.